And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Ro from San Diego.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Ro. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a real alcoholic. I'm the only member of my family who earned her seat in this room. And as probably most of you have figured out by now, I was originally born in England and grew up there, came here in 1978. You know, I knew when I got here that I was a real alcoholic because I looked back and realized that my early years were spent lying, cheating, stealing. I would rather tell a lie to keep everybody at bay than tell the truth. And I think that's one of the things that marks us all as alcoholics. I didn't start drinking until fairly late in life, 18. And before that, let me just kind of backtrack. I came from a really loving home. And my mother died committed suicide when I was 9. And there were 4 of us children. And so being the oldest, you know, I stepped up to the plate because that's what you do. And we had a series of nannies, and every time I would grow attached to one, she would leave and somebody else would come. And in my early teens, I got a stepmother, and she and I just did not get along. You know, I would find reasons not to go home after school because life was turbulent. And it seemed like it was only turbulent for me. My sister and my 2 brothers seemed to adapt quite well, but I felt like the odd man out. And my father and she would have arguments in the evening, and my bedroom was directly above the lounge, and I didn't necessarily hear all the words, but I knew what the content was. And she would leave in a huff, and my dad would make me call her the next morning to ask her to come back. And you know, it really sets up bad vibes when you have to do that. I was thrown out of the house when I was 17. And I went to college in London, and this was in the mid-60s, so I can tell you it was Freedom City. Now, I know in the States you always say, you know, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't really there. Well, mine was just filled with alcohol and men. And after I left college, I went to work for an advertising agency, and I can tell you that Mad Men is absolutely right on. I mean, I could write my own version. And I think that's kind of the difference between Europe and the States, is that we didn't have the availability of drugs. And in any case, I was sure that, you know, if I smoked a marijuana cigarette, it was going to absolutely screw up my drinking, and I didn't want that because, you know, as messed up as I was, I always felt that I was in control. And I got married quite, 21. And I'm this poor man. He was an accountant, and if there's any person in this world that should not be married to an accountant, it's me. I'm just one of those, you know, free spirits and all that good stuff. And the company that I worked for was just like Mad Men. You know, everybody was having an affair with everybody else. And I remember a Christmas party, and I was standing in a circle, and I'd got my husband, my previous lover, my current lover, and the guy that I got an eye on. And I'm thinking, life doesn't get any better than this, you know. Anyway, the first marriage, needless to say, didn't last all that long, and I did a moonlight flit. Do you call it a moonlight flit here in the States? Oh, that's where you just disappear. I packed a couple of bags, and a friend came and got me, and I invited my husband's best friend to dinner, left the dinner in the oven with a long note saying goodbye. And that's what a moonlight flit is. And he stalked me for about 18 months, and I had an intuition that he was about to find me, and I called him, and we managed to talk things out, and he let go. But he didn't take it very well, and he wrote this. He wrote a novel or a autobiography or whatever, and. Although I have a starring role in the book, I don't come out really, with the shining star, I'm afraid. Anyway, I guess once I left my first husband, I got into having a good time again, because, accountants don't like to party. I don't know what it is about them. Apologies to anybody that's an accountant in here. Anyway, I met a guy, and we were just like two peas in a pod. The only difference was that he was my designated driver. And I was married to this man for nearly 40 years. Oh, I forgot to say what my sobriety date is. My sobriety date is January the 13th of 1982. And so we were married over in England, and we decided to come over here because my parents were here. And we had spent the 8 years together in Europe, just having a really good time. It was, early 70s, what can I say? We just had a great time. And alcohol at that point was just an adjunct for me. It was part of having a good time. It wasn't an absolute necessity. We came to the States in 78, and alcohol became an absolute necessity for me. I drank in the morning. When I had the chance, I drank all day, and we would party at night. We would party at night for the first couple of years we were here, and then what happened is I would always drink too much, and I would actually be sitting in the lounge putting on my makeup at, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and fall asleep. So I was really, you know, Miss Party Girl, but I didn't actually get to go there. On occasions when we did get out and party, you know, I would throw up in all the inappropriate places. I would fall asleep on somebody's toilet. I would, you know, just all the... When the book says, you know, an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature, well, there's a picture of me sitting there, okay? And I did not anticipate, like I'm sure a lot of you did not anticipate coming into this program. I would manipulate my husband, like most of us are very good at doing, and I would be in the kitchen, you know, just throwing things together and coming up with all these wonderful things. And this one particular night, Ivan came back into the kitchen where I was drinking. And he didn't even say anything cruel. But I went straight to the phone and I called my parents and I said, I need help, I'm an alcoholic. And they came straight round. And as luck would have it, you know, my parents knew some people in the program and so they made a couple of phone calls. And it was agreed that somebody would come and pick me up the next morning to take me to a meeting. Do you know, that lady was not there at 8 o'clock in the morning. I thought, when they say, you know, they're serious about this program, doesn't that start as soon as my husband goes to work? They should have been there. And I drank everything in the house. By the time my dad came to pick me up at 11 o'clock, I couldn't stand. And the two ladies that came on my 12-step call are still friends of mine today. And I think that says so much for this program. They took me, they fed me coffee, they fed me soup, they fed me words of wisdom from Big Book. And the only thing that I remember of that day was Donna's husband, Bob, coming through the kitchen before we went to a meeting, and he said, "Hi, Ro, keep the plug in the jug." And I went, "Oh, now there's a very good idea." If you don't take the plug out of the jug, you can't get drunk. Anyway, they took me to a Tuesday night Big Book study that became the foundation of my program. I knew when I walked into that room that I was home. I felt comfortable in that room of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea why or how, but I was comfortable. And, you know, there's a story somewhere in the Big Book about apples and oranges. And it was like I was an apple in an orange world. And I came into the room, and you guys were all apples too. Now, some of you were Macintosh, and some of you were Fuji, and some of you were Braeburn, or, you know, whatever. But you were all apples. And I didn't have to explain myself. You know, you knew. You told my story every time you opened your mouth. And I believe that that was my spiritual awakening. I tried on my own to not drink, you know. I'm not going to drink today. But I would walk from my front door to my kitchen and pour myself a large drink. And if it got halfway down, I'd start topping it up. So I only had one drink. Stop me if you've ever heard that before. And the other thing is, oh my God, the bottles. getting those damn bottles out of the house to the trash can without them clinking and sounding like, you know, we'd had three parties on the same night, was just awful. And every time I take out my trash and it doesn't clink, and I go, oh, yay for sobriety. Oh, dear. Anyway, I was the kind of alcoholic that knew I belonged. And I remember sitting, I used to go to 2 or 3 meetings a day, because the only way that I knew I would stay sober was to go from meeting to meeting. You know, as long as there's no me time, then I'm okay. And I just thought this was the greatest thing since sliced bread. I wanted to tattoo AA on my forehead. I wanted to convert everybody in the world to this program. And the book tells us, you know, it's not just for alcoholics, that everybody will benefit. And I was the one that was going to do it. Well, somewhere along the line, I heard enough of somebody saying to me, take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. Because you don't know anything at all. And the longer I stay around, the more I feel I don't know, you know. But Alcoholics Anonymous for me has been a real lifesaver. I drank every day. I drove every day. And it is only by the grace of God that I did not kill somebody or kill myself. And I know that, you know, had I continued, I probably would have done. Oh, another lovely feature. I was scared to take a shower because I thought I would slip and fall. And so before, you know, towards the end of my drinking, I only took a shower if I really, really, really had to. Like I say, an unlovely creature. I was fortunate enough to get in with a group of women who really believed in working the steps, writing everything down, and you know, getting to the root of why we finish up here. And I'll tell you, I know from doing the steps over and over and over that I earned my seat in this room. I was told to, at the bare minimum, go to a women's clothes, to a big book study, and to a step study. And I hate to say it, but I don't go to the big book study anymore because they change it from Tuesday to Wednesday, and that doesn't fit in. But you know, I really believe in the steps are the key to this program. That if you don't get all of that goop out that we collected along the way, you're not going to be able to stay sober. Or if you stay sober, you're going to be miserable as hell. And quite frankly, if you're that miserable, you might as well drink or jump off the bridge or whatever. So the book tells us happy, joyous, and free, and we absolutely insist on being happy. And the fellowship that I have found in this program has carried me through. You know, one of my women's meetings that I go to, we talk about our village. And I was told that I had to have at least 5 people who knew everything about me. Now it seems like I'm going to have 200 people that know everything about me, but Oh, dear. Anyway, my husband came and gave me my one-year birthday token. And I had been so involved in the program that I nearly fell off my chair when he said, "This has been the worst year of my life." Because I'd forgotten to include him. I was so desperate to stay sober that all I'd done is go from meeting to meeting, and I was meeting all these great people, and I was coming back and telling him all about it, and blah, 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 blah. And he just felt so lonely, so forgotten. And so, thank goodness he did that at my first birthday and didn't wait till I was 10, you know, because that would have been really bad. Well, he probably wouldn't have been around. So I knew from that point that, you know, I included him in things that we did. And we had 40 years of the greatest life that two people could possibly have. He raced cars at Cajon Speedway for 20 years. We had a blast. We raised orchids. We had 2,000 orchids and just got involved with that and, you know, all the different species and this, that, and the other. He was just a master photographer, so he took loads of fantastic photographs. And when the racetrack closed, he's sitting on the couch and he says, "If I don't do something, I'm going to die." And he said, "I think I'll go on the stage." So, you know, typical Ivan, he got on the internet and he found all the theaters that were putting on productions. He sent off for all the scripts, he read them all, he chose all the parts he wanted to play, and he went for the audition. And he got the part. He never looked back, and he had a following of people that went from theater to theater to see him act, and he was just an absolute blast. Since we did things together, it took me out of my comfort zone again. The first production that he ever did, on dress rehearsal night, they said, "Here, you can do the light and sound board." I'm like, "Excuse me?" But you know what? I learned the light and sound board. And you can do that kind of stuff when you're sober. It's amazing. You know? You just follow direction. Whoa. So, like I said, my sobriety has been really, really blessed. I know for sure that I would be, well, I'd pretty much be dead, because I would have fallen in the shower or killed somebody in the car or done some other thing to not be here. And so I treasure each and every day. The foundation of my program is obviously going to meetings, but is also the fellowship. I've had quite a lot of, you know, bad things happen in the last few years, and I don't know if I would have made it through without a drink, without the people that I surround myself with. They are my rock. And you know, we get a chance when we come into this program to have honest relationships. How many of us have tried with, you know, person after person, whether it's a sibling or a parent or boy or girlfriend, that, you know, if we tried harder, then the relationship would get better. And you know what? I can only put in my 50%, and if the other person in the relationship chooses not to put in 50%, then we don't have a 100% relationship. And I think it's really important, because today we can be honest. You know, it took me quite a long time in this program to learn to say the truth. You know, they say the truth will set you free. But I had trouble with that. And I don't mind admitting it. But as in all things, you know, what happens is the only person you really cheat is yourself. Because you don't give a shit if I tell you a lie. Oh, sorry, I wasn't supposed to say shit. Anyway, you don't care if I tell a lie or not. And so I learned the hard way that being honest with yourself, you know, it, like the book says, you know, some of us are constitutionally incapable of being honest with ourselves. And that scared me. That scared me to understand what that meant, because I took such a long time getting to the point of being honest rather than telling a lie. And there are still times when my brain tells me to say something that's not true, and I have to wait and process it before I open my mouth. You know, I've told you how much I believe in the steps and the fellowship, and sponsorship is another thing that I really believe in. My sponsor was not able to be here tonight, but it's something that we need to do. The hand of AA was there for me when I came in. And it's important that each and every one of us has that ability to put our hand out and to be there for not just the newcomer, but for people who are hurting. You know, well, that's one of the things, is that nowhere in the book does it tell us that life is going to be a bed of roses once we get sober. And you know, so often we want everybody else to shape up to make our lives feel better. And they're not going to do that. At least the only way they are going to do that is when they can see how working this program is attractive, and that they want what we have. We are so fortunate to be able to be of service to God and our fellow man. There was a lady. I came from a meeting on Wednesday night. I needed gas, and I pulled into the gas station, and there was a lady in an SUV. And she said, "Excuse me, ma'am." And you know how most of us go, "Oh, Lord," you know, pit of your stomach comes up because you know they're going to ask you for something that you don't really want to give them. And it turned out that she had her two kids, 4 and 14, in the back of the car, and she had just left her abusive husband. And I truly, truly believe that God had her sitting in that gas station until I came along. She asked me for $2, and I managed to find $6. But what's more important is that I didn't have to fix her. I just had to encourage her. And, you know, I really believe that God uses us as a channel, like it says in the 11th step prayer. And it wasn't a coincidence that I was the person that drove up next to her in that gas station. And as I say, I didn't try and fix her. I gave her what I could. I gave her all the encouragement in the world to continue what she just, the decision that she just made. And you know, 99 people out of 100 would not have been able to do that. And I'm not saying that because I'm a special person. It's just that I've been around this program long enough to know that I am God's vessel, and that, you know, I'm able to be there for people when they need it, just as people were there for me. As I say, I've been in this program 31 years, and I've, apart from the first 10 years after that, I pretty much stuck to women's meetings. And a good friend of mine introduced me to a mixed meeting on Thursday night. It's called the Great Fact Group. We are all convinced that it's the best meeting in the world, but, you know, I know everybody has their favorites. But one of the things that attracted me to that meeting, and I've made it my home group now, is that people tell the truth and people show emotion, and people tell it like it is, even when it hurts. And, you know, we're always laughing because men cry at our meeting. And I think that's good. So, knowing that I was coming here, I brought my own hankies just in case. because, you know, things that happen in sobriety sometimes really, really hurt. I lost my husband 4 years ago after a 2-year battle with esophageal cancer, and my world fell apart. If it were not for the people in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here today. And all these things hurt. And I know that we all lose loved ones. But, you know, we just kind of been, like I said at the beginning, we were like two peas in a pod. The only difference was he didn't drink. And I think that must have saved my bacon an awful lot of times when I come to think of it. As a consequence, I lost my house, I lost my business, and since then I've lost both my dogs. And you know, we go through hard times. I am living on a pittance today. I'm used to being able to buy whatever I want. And like I say, nothing changes if nothing changes. Well, you know, a lot changed. And it's taken me, it's pretty much taken me 4 years to get back into the real world. The world of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still went to meetings, but I didn't take care of myself, and I didn't really give a damn what happened to me. Today I do. And you know, those spiritual awakenings that we talk about can happen in all kinds of different ways. And I think that I've had a spiritual awakening in figuring out that, you know, I hopefully still have plenty of life to live, and that if I'm depressed and I'm unkempt and I'm not the best me that I can be today, then I'm not going to be very attractive to the alcoholic who still suffers. And this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. We don't tell people what to do. We show them how it works. And it's such a message to all the newcomers that when we share the hurt that we are going through, and everybody goes through it at various times in their lives, we make ourselves vulnerable and we allow them to see that just because we've strung a few days together doesn't mean that everything is just hunky-dory. You know, we can have bad days, but I know very, very well that my worst day sober is way, way better than my best day drinking. For absolutely sure. So I think, you know, that's what I would just like to close with, is the message that we're here to help everybody. That when a newcomer walks into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, we all of us have the responsibility to hold out our hand and to say welcome. People did that for me, and I try to do that, to continue that, because, as it says, for that I am responsible. Thanks.